right, guys. Rolling along. Welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
John, it feels like it's been forever, man. It's
it has been. It's been almost a solid month. I mean, it seems like anyway.
That's right. That's right. Hope everyone, all of our listeners out there, have had a great Christmas. We're recording. Tomorrow's New Year's Eve, so
we
felt like this would be an appropriate time, given us given we're right on the cusp of a new year, and we skipped last week for a lot of different reasons.
That time of year, right? So, So we got a cool show coming up, I think, mainly because I thought of it, so that's why it's cool.
Exactly.
But we're going to talk about companies whose advertising slogan, not even the slogan, but just the idea they came up with, even apart from this, the slogan, were so big, such big ideas that it changed their entire industries and consumer behavior as a whole. Like, some of these might surprise you. Some of these I'm sure you've probably heard of if you're a student of marketing. Others you may not have heard of. And I just thought it was very interesting to see how, when you really get a big idea, it can transform an entire industry, not just a company. So,
I mean, it's one thing to change a consumer behavior or change a consumer's opinion from one product to another. It's an entirely different thing to change their whole behavior pattern.
Yeah.
So much so that they change what they do. You know, not just the choice they make, but actually what they do within that, you know, within those.
Right. Yeah. This is not going from Frosted Flakes to the Kroger brand or the HEB brand or whatever store brand, like, or from Frosted Flakes to Raisin brand. Like, it's not, you know, that's a cross brand switch, which is not easy, by the way. That's, that's difficult as well. But this is like almost inventing a whole new category.
Yeah.
And or just completely upping the frequency with which people use your product. And that's what most of these are. It was kind of a frequency. Like, we'll talk about them as we go through them. And we'll, so maybe we could do that. Maybe we could talk about each one of these. Like, did they, you know, J. Abraham's three things, right? You get more customers, you get them to buy more often, or you get them to buy more per transaction.
Absolutely.
Right. So we'll see what, which of these they checked off as we go through them.
We'll give you a hint. Think of the, we talked about this before the show. Think of the frequency of your oil change.
You know,
how often do you actually change? Now, if you're like me, I'm beyond, you know, I'm beyond all that. I'm beyond all that marketing and all that, advertising, but I mean, it's really fascinating when you dig into some of the habits that we just go about
and
we take for granted. We go about our daily lives and we just do them from a routine standpoint. We don't really question things, but when we actually get to the origin of it, I think you're going to find that it's very interesting that so many of these things come from marketing and advertising. So
what?
No way.
Marketers, I tell you, they're tough. All right. Let's talk about beverages because we've got a special beverage that we've been holding on to until we got back around to the episodes, right? Because we took a little bit of a break.
Sure.
So I sent you some, like, this is the first time in like a year since I moved out to Austin.
Yes.
That we've been using the same beer. Right. So we used to do that all the time when we were there in your studio.
Yep.
So I mailed you some stuff because I saw this come on the shelves here at HEB and I was like, I've got to send that over to Jonathan because it's my favorite brewer and it's from Tupps Brewery and it's called Full Grown Beast.
It's a beast. All right. Let me just read this. 16.3%. That's a beast.
That's a beast. So we'll be drinking both of them today within 30 minutes. But it's so, you think of it, it's so strong that it's not even a 4-pack. It's a 2-pack.
It's a, exactly.
So yeah. And I'll read the copy on it real quick. It says, let me adjust my glasses a little bit. So aged in Kentucky bourbon barrels, this beast is loaded with rich with rich barrel flavors of vanilla and oak, topped off with coffee and chocolate to take it to the next level. This Imperial Stout is huge, flavorful, yet incredibly balanced. And like you said, it's 16.3%. I don't see IBUs, but my guess is it's super. I've got a lot of hopes for this, but I'm also cautious because when you start getting into those alcohol ranges, like you can get into some pretty, especially an Imperial Stout, you can get into some pretty sweet stuff. So I hope it's not like syrup when I open this can.
Untappd says no IBUs. What does that mean? No IBUs.
Like there's no bitterness. It's just all sweet. So yeah, and it's got the, you may recognize the can if you've been watching on YouTube or things like that, but it's from the same brewery that had the full grown St. Nick Christmas beer and the full grown Jack for Halloween and really good, just a good brand. I love all their full grown series. So,
all right.
Have you poured yours yet?
I am about to pop the top here. There we go. Splattered my screen there. You can tell I've been out of the game for weeks. Oh man, it's like zero head. Well, a little bit.
It's got a little bit.
There it goes.
It's not as dark and heavy looking as I thought it would be.
Now, full disclosure, this is like the first beer I've had almost in a couple of weeks.
Wow. I hope you've eaten today.
Oh,
I was snacking on some crackers. I was like, I better eat something because that could be embarrassing.
So I got to give full disclosure. So I've had COVID like the last week and a half or so.
So don't get too close to the speakers.
I'm keeping my distance from the mic.
Good.
But I'm actually getting it back slowly, but for a week there, I had no taste, no smell. Now things just taste differently. So I'm getting taste back, but things just say taste awkward. You know, some things taste pretty good for the most part. Things just don't taste right. So,
but did you die?
I'm fully alive and I'm getting my strength back. So
you're one of the 99.9%.
That's right.
You're That's so right. special.
And I might be able to, I'm curious how this is going to taste. So,
well, I'm going to,
let me see if I can give it smell up. I can actually smell. Yeah, I can smell this.
All right. Well, let's give it a cheers and a taste and we'll see. All right. See where we're at.
There we go. Mm. Yeah. I might need to wait a week on the next one.
That's strong.
It's strong. Yeah.
You can actually taste the alcohol in that.
You said earlier today, given my condition, it might taste more like medicine. And,
yeah.
And that's probably close. It's pretty close.
Yeah. It actually even tastes like that to me. And my taste is fine. So it does have I think that's the alcohol coming through. It's so much alcohol in it. It's probably coming through a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's got a lot of it's got a lot of different flavors going on. So
it is 16. So
yeah,
I think that's got to be one of our highest.
That's the highest beer I've ever had. I think, I think I've had 12 or 14, but 16.3, that's pretty high. Like it almost feels like a bourbon going down. Like it's got a little warmth in the old esophagus there as it goes down. So that tells you the content's pretty high.
Well, I'm going to let you, because I'm not going to give it a fair rating.
Well, so it's not what I hoped. I'll tell you that. Okay. It's not nearly as good as their other ones. Probably just that the alcohol content's so high. It's probably one of those beers that it's kind of like Jägermeister, right? You drink it just because it's got the 16%, right, and it's got a crazy taste. So I'm going to give this hate to do this to Tupps Brewery, but I'm going to give it like a 2.8 or a 3. Well, I'll give it a 2.9, split the difference there. Because it's not smooth at all. So we'll let it air out a little bit, see if it, some of these stronger beers, once they air out a little, they get better. Yeah. But I can feel it just like a bourbon, like
coming
here in my chest. Like I can feel that warmth a little bit in the throat.
Sure.
So I think that's what it is. So once it settles in, it's kind of like that first sip of bourbon is really strong. And then gets smoother as you drink it.
Absolutely.
So that's what I'm going to go with. So for now it's 2.9. If I need to adjust it later, I will, but and we can try it again. Well, I'll save mine. We can try it again in a couple weeks.
Okay.
When you're fully recovered. But
absolutely.
But you got to love the marketing, the can, the box.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Stuff. These guys do great with everything. Cause you've had a number of these on before.
I've had four or five different beers of theirs. Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's jump in. So we'll ease into the waters a little bit. We'll kind of go with the obvious one. So okay. People can don't tune out just because you've heard the story before, because you may not have heard all the other stories.
Right.
You've heard of them. You just may not be soup, you know, may not have thought about them in this context. Mm-hmm. Usually this first company that we talk about, you hear about, this is always an example of like a good USP. Oh, that's a really good, I mean, it's in all, like every marketing book has this as a USP example. Right. And we're kind of going beyond that. We're talking about, was it the USP that drove the success of the entire industry? Mm-hmm. Or what, or, you know, kind of what was going on there? Was it just good timing? Like what happened? But the first one is Domino's Pizza.
Right.
Like,
How can you not talk about Domino's Pizza?
Yeah. I mean, I think like that was the first delivery, at least for me, us and probably you too, Jonathan, growing up in Georgia. It's not like we grew up in New York City, right, where maybe that was a little bit more common. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I've never lived in like a big city like that downtown. Mm-hmm. So for the suburbs and even the country a little bit, Domino's was like the first place you could really just get it come all the way to your doorstep.
Right.
There's a few places that might've had takeout, the Chinese restaurant, things like that. But even that, I was trying to think back like in the 80s when Domino's, you know, kind of came on, like, mm-hmm, I don't remember us ever getting anything else delivered to the house. No. I mean, now you can get anything delivered.
You know? And there may have been some like small mom and pop.
Yeah. Well, most of those were like, you go pick them up.
Right. Right.
And it was takeout. They weren't actually delivered to you.
Sure.
But that raised the bar for the entire food industry. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking the other day, like, what if Domino's had never pioneered that? And then we hit COVID in this pandemic and like everybody had to figure out delivery all of a sudden. Obviously somebody would have figured out between,
sure,
you know, the 80s or 70s, whenever Domino's started, mm-hmm, and now. But now, I mean, you think about Uber delivery and Postmates and, absolutely, you know, everything else that's, you can literally get anything you want delivered to your door. Yep. Is just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah,
Uber. And it raised the bar for the entire industry. I mean, not just the pizza industry, like, yeah, food in general. Mm-hmm. It was pizza for a long time.
Yeah.
But now it's pretty much everything.
Grubhub, Uber Eats. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about it. Anything you want, pretty much, can be delivered straight to your door.
Yeah, between those and, you know, Amazon delivery, you can get groceries, you can get,
yeah,
all kinds of stuff. And on demand, like, you know, depending on where you live.
Yeah.
But most of these companies, you know, especially the bigger ones, are in every town. There's a Domino's in every town.
Sure.
Or at least the next town over.
Yep.
You know? So yeah, it's, that was one that just really, it wasn't just a great USP. It was an industry innovation.
Yeah.
That changed the entire industry and changed human behavior, mm-hmm, to the point where, when if parents we didn't, went out for date nights, they just ordered pizza for the kids. You were, right, like buying two dinners instead of one.
Yeah.
It was no longer leftovers. It was like, here's $20 for the sitter, buy pizza for the kids, you know, in an hour, that kind of thing. Like, it just totally changed everything.
And it also changed, in a way, it changed our expectation, you know, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Or it's free. Right.
Right.
And so, yep, we almost demanded, you know, from that standpoint, it changed our expectation to not only get it delivered to us, but get it delivered to us in a time. Fast. Yeah. In a really fast time. You know, it was like,
God, faster than you could make, sit down and make dinner.
Exactly.
Or stand up and make dinner, whichever. Yeah. So not only was it delivered to you, it was faster than, mm-hmm, you could probably make dinner yourself from scratch.
Yep.
So, that's one. So which one do you want to talk about next? You've got a list there as well.
I like the, let's see, Well, we hinted on the oil change. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Let's jump to that one. Every 3,000 miles. So I don't know about you, but whenever I go to the get your oil changed at your local place, yep. they slap a little sticker on.
Yep.
It says this many, what is it? Is it three months or 3,000 miles?
Yep.
And they give you basically every time they list exactly when you should bring that in, which is always 3,000 miles from when they change the oil. So yep. it's still, I mean, with us today, and a lot of people still do that. Every 3,000 miles, you get your oil change, right?
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, for a while it was 5,000. They lowered it to 3,000. So people yeah. would come in by 5,000 because then you feel really guilty by five if it's every 3,000 miles, right? Right. But yeah, but if you look in most owner's manuals, especially today, mm-hmm. you know, most cars can go 7,500, 15,000 miles. Some of the newer cars, it's like 100,000 mile oil change.
Yep.
Because it's such a closed compartment and synthetics and all this other stuff that you don't need it. But that idea, it has just absolutely persisted despite the change in oil technology, despite the improvement in cars.
Sure.
Like, despite all this other stuff that's happening, mm-hmm. the oil change industry, and I was trying to figure out who started it, if it was Jiffy Lube or somebody else. I was doing some research. I couldn't find it. Yeah. Jiffy Lube seems to be the one that took the most advantage, but it doesn't seem like they're the ones that came up with it. Mm-hmm. From what I can tell, it was like a very specific oil type, like 5W40 or one of the, actually might've been 10W40 or one of the higher, the narrower ranges that was popular back in the 70s, mm-hmm. that was, you wanted to change every three or 5,000 miles because of the heat and yeah. all that kind of stuff. Right. But as soon as they changed that formula and made it more durable, basically, mm-hmm. you didn't need that anymore. It was at least 5,000. And for most owner's manuals, it was like 7,500.
Yeah.
But that idea of get your oil changed every 3,000 miles made all these pop-up shops happen, these, mm-hmm. you know, Pennzoil, Jiffy Lube, sure. Precision Tune, like all these shops that specialize in oil changes became really popular. People stopped changing their oil at home because it was too much of a hassle too often.
Right.
Not completely stopped. You still got the people that like to do that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Most of the country doesn't want to do that.
No, it's so convenient just to pull it in. And
yeah, because if you do it yourself, then you got to get rid of the oil. It's mm-hmm. like, it's just a pain.
Disposal fees and all that stuff.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, that's one of those things that it brought an entire industry up when they hit on that 3 months or 3,000 miles. Yeah. And I do think it was Jiffy Lube that kind of came up with that slogan mm-hmm. and really popularized it and got it out into culture, not just among car heads and things like that. Right. So yeah, that's one that just, it keeps sticking, even though it's no longer true.
And think about even today, like the little sticker, you know,
yeah.
up above, you know, right, to remind you every time, just yeah. how brilliant that is on their part. Of course, you know, we ignore it, but a lot of people don't, because they're looking at that thing going, oh crap, you know,
and you feel guilty every time you're, you get in the car and you're a couple miles over.
Right.
You're like, oh my God, my car's going to blow up at any minute, right?
Or so, a month over. Even with today's new technology where you can, like, you know, I don't know about your Jeep, but on mine, it shows the, you know, it even gives them, you can scroll through and select a meter, like right. the electronic meter, and says, you know, what your life, you know, the life expectancy of your oil is. And yep. usually even way past 3,000 miles, you know, it's like 60%, you know, it's still, yeah,
right.
it's still great. So your own car is telling you that your oil is just fine.
Yeah.
But no, yeah. you know, a lot of us just ignore that. Just like we ignore our own car manuals. I mean, who reads a car manual anymore?
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, most people never take the shrink wrap off of them. You know, and now a lot of the newer cars, it's like a PDF online somewhere. Like right. you don't even get the owner's exactly. book because the glove compartments are so small, they can't fit it in there. You know, so yeah, that's another example. So the other one I want to talk about was, we'll go with Volkswagen.
Yeah.
So when Volkswagen came over, and this is one of the most iconic, like, Madison Avenue ads, was the Think Small campaign. But what was, like, a lot of people, if you see that now, maybe younger people, it doesn't really make that much sense. Like, it's like, why was that such a big deal? Like, it yeah. just doesn't, seem like that great of an ad campaign. But if you think about this, so this was like the 50s when they started rolling over, late 50s, I think is when it was, when they came over.
And everybody was driving.
Yeah, you think about the 57 Chevy, like these were big, all steel cars that were just massive, right? I mean, you think about the first Back to the Future movie and all the cars there, or Karate Kid and the all the cars he was waxing, you know, wax on, wax off, like all those cars, those big 50s cars, that's what ruled the road back then. So Volkswagen comes in with this idea that's totally counterintuitive, totally counterculture, and says, think small. And they did two things at once. One, they made small okay for a certain, you know, segment of the population, which then grew over time. Right. But at the same time, they brought in imports. There wasn't a lot of imports at that time either. You know, Japanese technology had not caught up yet with the rest of the world. So Honda and Toyota, while they were around, weren't great names yet, because we had not sent Edward Deming over. I think it's Edward. Was it Deming?
Yeah.
That did the you know, the incremental improvement. You know, he hadn't gone over there yet and fixed everything. So it was kind of the first, they were the first company to kind of bring on and make imports okay and small cars okay. Now, there's still a lot of people that made fun of them. But they're the ones that came in and just created this whole new category of cars. And
not only changed that, the industry. A car with a trunk in the front, you know? How unique was that?
And I think car with like, personality, because a lot of the cars looked very similar. I mean, you had some Mustangs and some, you know, Corvettes and things like that, but those were sports cars. Those weren't really everyday cars. You know, those were a little bit different. So when Volkswagen comes over with the Bug, the Beetle, and like, it's an everyman's car, it's small. The engine's in the wrong place. Like it's, I mean, all kinds of, it's not even water cooled. It's air cooled, not water cooled. Like it's just, they just broke every rule in the book. And, you know, you see those iconic campaigns like Think Small, and I don't know if it was the campaign or if it's just really good timing, right? A very good product. Like all of these that we're going to mention, most of these we're going to mention are very good products. There's probably one exception that the product doesn't really matter. But most of them, the product, they were different products. So they kind of stood out. It's kind of the red ocean, blue ocean kind of idea. But they were so good that they elevated the entire industry.
Yeah. If you see the original ad, and most people are familiar with it because it's just, it's a very clean, simple ad, you know, with that Volkswagen on there.
Big. And these were back in, you know, big magazine days, right? So everything was a full page ad, and the whole ad took up like a third of the page, and there's just a lot of white space. Little tiny picture of the car. And I think it was, a photograph. I don't think it was a sketch drawing at that time. It's still a photograph. I have one around here somewhere, but if you just look up Think Small, Google Images will pop them all up. But yeah, it was like, it was small on the page too. Like
is,
they
that really went all in. Is that,
I'm not sure if it was or not. I don't know. I know it's in the book. I don't know if it was his or not, though. But yeah, and I, that's what I was thinking earlier, too. Glad you mentioned that. Like, Ogilvy talks about what this big idea is, and it's an idea that can last for like 30 years. And I think another way, he doesn't say this in the book, but I think another way to define a big idea is that it does what we're talking about today. It completely transforms entire industries and rises all boats because it's just such a powerful, just totally catapults everything. All right, what's the next? You got two or three more. Which one you want to go for?
I like the diamonds. Let's look at the Diamonds Are Forever campaign.
Yeah, so if you're a... if you're a pretty astute marketer or copywriter, you probably have heard this story. I found a little bit of nuance to it that I thought was kind of like, what kind of cool, but so De Beers is the one that has really, that kept diamonds alive after the Depression. And I kind of knew that De Beers was the one behind the diamond. I didn't know the whole story. And basically that is, that after the Depression, people were like, you know, diamonds are a little expensive. Like, it's just not something we can afford. It's only for rich people.
Right.
And sales were plummeting. Mm-hmm. Makes sense, right?
Yep.
So they came out with this idea of a diamond is forever. Mm-hmm. And like for 1947. Again, I think there's a lot of timing here. Here's what was really funny. A diamond is forever. That slogan. Nobody in the office liked it at the ad agency.
Interesting.
And it was like a junior copywriter that came up with it. And they were like, well, we don't have anything better, so let's pitch this to the client. And that's like the backstory. So it's not like somebody was like, oh my God, this is the best idea ever. It just hits and it just makes sense, which is a good example of why you got to test even stuff that you don't mm-hmm. necessarily love. Because, I mean, it really, if you think about it from a, if you were sitting around a group of copywriters, they'd be like, a diamond is forever. It's like, yeah, it's a little, it's kind of, you know, doesn't really say anything specific. It's not ultra, like it wouldn't match the four U's of copywriting, right? It's not ultra specific. It's not unique. It's not useful. Like it doesn't hit the four U's of a headline. And yet, Ad Age, not that they're the be all end all, but they called it the best slogan of the 20th century.
And for what reason? Why did that resonate so much with the average consumer who thought at the time that diamonds are just like, whoa, you know, that's a luxury item.
Right. It's because of the way they tied it to the idea of marriage. Mm. Right. So you have this stone, you say a diamond is forever.
Sure.
So, which if you think about it, pretty much any rock lasts forever. I mean, you could just pick right. up a stone out of the river. It's going to last
a block
pretty much forever. You know, I mean, like, let's be real, like a pet rock also lasts forever if you don't lose it.
Yeah.
But the idea was a diamond is forever. Mm-hmm. Like if you think about it, it's not unique. Any rock is going to outlast generations of people.
Yeah.
Any rock.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's, oh, you found the one thing about a diamond that's unique. No, it's not really unique. It's just, we just made it up.
Yeah.
And that's probably why they didn't love it. They're probably like, well, how any rocks forever. Like, exactly. I don't, why is that special? But they did a good job of tying it to the marriage proposal, mm-hmm. making it special. Mm-hmm. And it created this whole ritual. When they saw it start to take off, they created this whole ritual around getting married, including the 3-month salary thing, which was a later campaign. Right. So now they've upped the value of diamonds by saying they're worth 3 months salary. Mm-hmm. But by tying the stone to something that people thought should last forever, a marriage, it had a nice, you know, it became a nice symbol mm-hmm. of something that's going to last forever. Just like the gold ring is round because it's infinite.
Right.
You put a diamond on top of it because it's also forever. Right. So,
sure.
You know, it was clever. It was a lot of things in it. But if you also think about the timing, 1947, that's when a lot of, what was that, World War II, coming home, people getting married,
absolutely.
Like the boom, like all that kind of stuff. So I think a lot of these are really good timing as well. Mm-hmm. You know, cashing in on trends that they almost byproducts. It's not like they did these on purpose. That's what's kind of funny about a lot of these is they didn't set out to change industries.
No.
Or and transform by consumer behavior other than, you know, maybe Domino's, they just wanted to sell a few more pizzas and, you know, they started on college campuses. It wasn't, they thought it was a good idea. It's like, well, they can't come pick it up because they don't have cars. Because back then, not every kid had a car.
Right.
Right. So they had to deliver it to the dorm rooms and to the frat houses and all that kind of stuff. That was just like necessity. It wasn't brilliant.
Yeah.
It was more like, well, we'll bring it to you. Mm-hmm. And then they refined it and all that kind of stuff. Sure. So. So that's what's funny about these is they're not necessarily genius. They are looking back, but if you really think about putting yourself in those times, it's good timing, having the right product, a good solid product, you know, at a good time in the market. I know that doesn't necessarily help everyone listening.
And think about the emotional appeal, right?
Yeah.
It's not a logical thing. Mm-hmm. There's nothing logical about buying a diamond. You know, it's expensive.
That's what I keep telling my wife.
But
she doesn't get it.
From an emotional standpoint, you tie that to, you know, marriage, you know, diamond is forever. And then you tie that to the, obviously, you know, a guy who wants to, you know, show that, you know, the uniqueness. Obviously, he wants to impress that soon to be wife. Obviously, you know, so, and the expectations on the other side, you know, when you market something like that, a diamond is forever. If you give this, then obviously you're expecting, you're tying your marriage in, you know, with a symbol of
foreverness.
Yeah.
So it's like, so I was thinking like Eugene Schwartz, we've talked about this, you know, 100 times on the show. It's like, you don't create desire. You link the existing desire,
absolutely, which
for a woman who wants to get married, you know, it's safety, security, right, companionship, you know, same for the guy, different, some different things in there for the guy as well. But like, you know, there's this already existing desire that they linked their product to. They didn't create the desire for people to be in a, you know, long-term relationship that already existed. And they figured out a way to link their product to that existing desire.
Yeah.
And that's the true for all of these, right? Even Volkswagens, like people were starting to get tired of, you know, big cars that were hard to park, or as, you know, neighborhoods got more crowded, or, you know, just gas guzzling and maintenance and all that kind of stuff. So they came out with this Think Small. Plus just the desire to be different, right? Because the counterculture was starting to take place, and a lot of this other stuff. You know, the oil is just to keep your main mode of transportation reliable. That's what they're tapping into there. So let's, got a couple more, and I know you're short on time, but let's look at, I thought this one was interesting. So back in 1907, the California orange growers hired an ad agency to help them sell more oranges because people just weren't eating enough oranges. They were growing more than people were buying. So they came up with this idea. First of all, they created a whole co-op around these growers and called them Sunkissed Orange. And they created this idea that it had not been done before, really. I'm sure somebody had done it, but it wasn't common practice, and it's called orange juice. Right. And they started marketing this as a breakfast drink. There's nothing about orange juice that makes it breakfast or dinner or lunch or anything else. Right. It's just, but this ad campaign was a way to get people to buy more oranges. And originally, like, you couldn't go to the grocery store and buy a carton of orange juice. Like, first of all, refrigeration was not huge in 1907. Like, it was not in every house, those kind of things, much less in most grocery stores. So it's not like you could have the, you know, the boxed orange juice that we have now. So mostly what they ended up selling the oranges, and then they sold juicers that you actually juiced your orange with. Both the handheld, and I think eventually the electronic, and then eventually you rolled into orange juice production with refrigeration and all that stuff. But, you know, that's a whole category and a use for oranges that did not exist before 1907. You know, people just probably just, I guess they just ate oranges. You know, you didn't drink them, you just ate them. And now it's like the opposite, right? It's like you drink orange juice, but people hardly eat them. Like,
it's,
you
know, too much trouble.
Yeah, it's too much trouble. Just drink a glass of orange juice.
You know, it's funny, back a long time ago, before, I'd say before orange juice, people looked at oranges. I mean, they were like, I mean, it was like a treat, you know? You don't think about it. But you, it's not like you were, it's not like you go to the grocery store and pick up like a huge, you know, 5-pound bag of oranges or whatever, you know, and just take home. It wasn't
you
that
had to
available.
Be fairly close to Florida or California.
That's right.
Or Mexico, or, you know, somewhere Sunshine State. You didn't have the logistics and the supply chains and all that kind of stuff that we have now. So yeah, those were treats.
My wife's, I remember her grandmother talking about, like, back in when, in her younger days, you know, them getting like an orange, like for Christmas, you know,
in the stocking.
Exactly. It was like a treat.
Sweet and special. It was like candy. Now we just do candy. But do you remember, did your grandparents have the micro glasses for orange juice? Because it was so special. No, like you couldn't. No. I don't. We had these little tiny glasses. I mean, they were like not much bigger than a shot glass. It was like a little bit tall, twice as tall as a shot glass. Right. And that was like your juice glass. You didn't have those? None of your... Oh man, that was, yeah, I'm sure there's some listeners here that had that experience, but yeah, it was like gold. Like you couldn't, and even when you used to go out to restaurants, like, you know, orange juice came in the little, at Waffle House, it came in the short glasses and everything else came in the big glass. Right. Cause orange juice is special.
Special. Like, yeah.
Special.
Premium. So,
and the fact is it was just a tactic to get rid of excess oranges. And now it's like, you know, gold.
Yeah. Side note too, the McDonald brothers, I was watching, this was months ago, but I was watching a documentary. That's how they first got started, was even before they were selling hamburgers. They were selling like hot dogs and like orange juice. That was how they got their first start, with a little orange juice stand.
Yeah. Yeah. Who doesn't love a good hot dog and orange juice combination?
Exactly. Wow.
That's crazy. All right. Last one. We'll finish up with this one. So the coffee break, mm-hmm. I mean, we all drink, I mean, we're coffee obsessed in this country at this point. Right. I mean, there's more coffee brands than you can comprehend and it's like new ones every day.
Yep.
But the idea of the coffee break came about from obviously a coffee manufacturer and an ad agency for coffee. So in the 1950s, before that, the coffee break did not exist. Like you didn't have, and it's, you know, you and I, we work from home and things like that. So it's not as big of a deal now, but you know, if you're in an office, there's that kind of 10 AM break, or if you're in, especially if you're in manufacturing, there's the 10 AM or 10:30 or so, somewhere in that area break. Yep. That's a coffee break, right? Well, that didn't exist. That was made up by an advertising agency in the 1950s. And here's what's crazy. By the 1964, it was so popular that the United Auto Workers threatened a strike if they didn't get a coffee break written into their contract. I mean, that's pretty amazing that they can change entire workplace cultures in a decade with one ad campaign. I mean, what would that do for your business if people were going on strike because they couldn't have your product in their life?
Absolutely.
And that's crazy to think about.
That's amazing. I'm sure there was probably a Marlboro tied into that too, right?
Yeah.
Smoke break.
Yeah.
Smoke break, coffee break.
Yep. And those campaigns were very, very close. That was actually one that was on my list. Mm-hmm. That I cut, but because I didn't want to encourage smoking among our listeners. So
sure, of course.
But actually, Marlboro was originally a woman's cigarette. Did you know that?
I did. Yeah, I think we've talked about that on a past episode. Yeah,
because it was filtered, mm-hmm. and filters were like for sissies, for women.
Right. That's right.
So they had to totally repackage it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think. I mean, it did help sales overall. I don't think that had as big of like. Behavior effect. I guess it brought a lot more men into filtered cigarettes, but they were already smoking some type of cigarette.
Sure.
So to me, that's not the same category as some of these we've been talking about today. Mm-hmm. And then last one real quick, toothpaste.
How could you not talk about toothpaste, right?
Did you know that we don't actually need toothpaste?
No, say it's not so.
That's like crazy. It's completely made up. Yep. And it's, I was kind of disappointed when I read that. I was like, oh my God, how much money have I spent on toothpaste and toothbrushes over the years that I don't actually need them? So yeah, toothpaste and guess who's to blame for that?
I would say
one of our heroes, actually.
One of our heroes. He's an advertiser. I would say Claude Hopkins.
You are correct.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yep. And Pepsodent was like the first like big toothpaste that helped popularize that feeling of a clean mouth, but it's actually not part of the saliva in your mouth does the job of cleaning your mouth. Like you don't actually need toothpaste to do that. So, but it was that feeling, that tingle with the peppermint and the brushing the film off your teeth, which is actually not that harmful, that that people liked, and they got addicted to that ritual, which is also by the way, the Febreze story. Mm-hmm. It's people got used to that kind of, when they did all the studies, we talked about the Febreze thing, like when they felt, after they sprayed it, they kind of felt this, it was like the cherry on top of the cake. Like it was the finishing flourish of cleaning. Mm-hmm. That kind of marked the end of their cleaning routine. Sure. And that's actually what made Febreze successful. Not the smell, not what it did, but that last, and they still do in their commercials to this day, like they spray and they take the big breath and it's like, oh, accomplishment.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually the accomplishment of cleaning. Mm-hmm. Not the smell and stuff that makes Febreze so popular.
Just like a, you know, toothpaste. Yeah, it makes your mouth feel clean, right?
Right.
So most of what's in a typical toothpaste is nothing that you essentially need, but it certainly makes you feel clean, especially after you gargle with the, you know, the Listerine.
Yeah.
Complete the process.
Yeah, you use the toothbrush to like break open your gums, and then you pour alcohol down in the gums with Listerine so that it burns, and you're like, I've done something. I've
done something. It feels like something's going on.
Yeah, so.
So if you have an honest dentist out there, and I've had a dentist before that's actually told me that very thing. All you need, you don't really need toothpaste. Just brush your teeth, you know.
Yeah, just get the film off a little bit, or get the chunks out of your teeth is basically all you're doing.
That's right. Floss. So, do a little brushing, forget the toothpaste.
Yeah, so. But it doesn't feel the same. You don't get the same dopamine hit, the same reward, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's you know, those kind of things. So I guess the big lesson is, how could you take your product, your entire industry, mm-hmm. and find this existing desire somewhere mm-hmm. that maybe has not been tapped into real well, and tie your product to it in such a way that it just explodes an entire industry.
Absolutely.
Or even just your brand, your product. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I'm not sure you can just craft that. Like I guess Claude Hopkins did, mm-hmm. But most of these other ones kind of stumbled into it. Well, I guess not. I guess Orange Juice, they did it. Very intentionally.
Let's think of from a modern standpoint. Let's think of something, a modern product today, and the thing that we gravitate to is social media, right?
Yeah.
So what is that?
That is a product, by the way.
Yeah, it is a product. So it tapped into, because my wife and I, we actually watched when we had during Christmas week last week, we actually watched a little bit of the movie The Social Network. So it's kind of the original. It's actually a fascinating movie. Mm-hmm. If you get a chance, you should definitely check it out.
What's cooler than $1 billion? $1 billion.
$1 billion. So yeah, it's pretty interesting because he basically tapped into at that time, you know, because it's about the origin of Facebook, mm-hmm. but tapped into something that people already wanted, which was what? Social connection. And it really started out as just a social network on campus and realized like the potential of this, like expanding not only from Harvard campus, but also, or the Harvard network, but also to different other college networks. And then, you know, from that point on, it you know, blew up outside of college. What's crazy is
it basically started out as almost like a Tinder, right?
Yep.
Like hot or not.
Exactly. Like
type thing.
That's right.
And then it, you know, progressed and people started communicating, setting up parties and all that kind of stuff. Like, so really it goes back to sex, right? That's really what made it successful. Same with toothpaste.
Connection. Like, yeah, exactly.
Right. So if you can tie your product to sex, like mm-hmm. the diamond ring, right? The guy wants long-term sex. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what we're selling here.
Across
the board, right? So let's just get back to, like, if you really want to up your sales, that's the takeaway for this program. Somehow tie it to
sex, money.
You'll be fine. So, all right, I guess we'll end the year with that note because I know you got to run. Last thing. I did see Wonder Woman, streamed Wonder Woman 1984.
Okay, tell me, because we're considering,
is that where you're going?
Checking that. Oh, well, I think we're just going to stream it on Apple.
Yeah, so it's on HBO Max, I think, so you stream it through that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was actually pretty good. It was very much like the original as far as the quality and the storyline and kind of thing. So it was good. Maybe we can talk about that on, if you watch it in the next week, we'll talk about that on the next episode.
Yeah.
Without doing too many spoilers, but there's some interesting numbers behind it. Mm-hmm. Cause this is like the first like big movie that has been simultaneously released in the theaters and online. And there's some interesting statistics that they're finding from this. So we can kind of look at what's going on there and some of that stuff, but, is it worth getting? Yeah. Is it the same experience at home as it is in the theater? Not in my house. Maybe if you have the right home theater. And I've got a nice TV and sound system, but it's still not the same. There's too many, for me, there's a little too many distractions.
Sure.
You know, just, you don't get that same trance effect that you get in a theater.
Right. And I think that's part of the experience of any movie is that you're kind of, you know, you're focused in.
Yeah, I mean,
I think at home you have way too many distractions.
Yeah,
and I think that's where,
you know, especially with open floor plans and all the other, you know, stuff that's so cool these days. Like, if you don't have a dedicated media room, it's hard to get that same movie theater effect.
Sure,
and that's like, I really liked the movie, but I did find myself kind of, you know, losing that trance-like state that I had in the theater.
Yeah,
you know, and the experience of going there, settling into the seats and, you know, popcorn, all that kind of stuff. Like, I just find that hard to duplicate at home. Some people, I don't know if it's just our generation feels that way. It'd be interesting to get some feedback on that from listeners and like, you know, is that generational?
No, I don't think it's generational. And I think that Hollywood has taken a huge, huge hit right now.
Yeah.
From everything that I've read, they're in dire straits, you know, if things don't change. So
yeah, for sure. So
it will be interesting. Well, that will be a good discussion on an upcoming.
Well, if nothing else, you know, we streamed it for free basically with our current HBO package.
Sure.
We had three people sitting there watching it for that same free ticket. Mm. So just from a revenue standpoint, certainly not a win.
Yeah.
Right. So instead of three tickets at the movie theater plus concessions and all the other stuff. So yeah.
Yeah. I really think the experience effect, cause that's part of, I mean, you think about the movies.
I mean, that's what it is, right?
It's a whole experience.
Yeah.
And when you take away that with what, you know, especially over what's happened over 2020 with COVID and, you know, so many theaters being shut down, people not going to the theaters anymore. I mean, to me, a movie is an experience where you're going to it, especially an early release type movie. And that's where, you know, that's what people kind of tune into. I think it's just, it takes away from the movie experience. I don't care how good it is, you know, when you're watching it at home, because there's way too many distractions and,
yeah. Maybe that's what we should talk about on the next episode. Let's maybe we can get an expert on, you know, next week for like experience marketing.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Talk about some experiences and some different ways that we're either missing out on those, and I'm sure there's some pent up demand for those kind of things. And we'll dive into the numbers for Wonder Woman and things like that too.
Yeah.
On the next episode. But
sounds good.
I will say I think my beer has gotten better.
Has it?
But it's still not like an easy drinking beer. Like it's not an easy drinking Imperial Stout. It's still got that alcohol bite to it.
So are you still sticking with your 2.9?
I am.
Okay.
Unfortunately, like it's just not, I'm going to have to go get some other stuff so that you don't have a bad taste in your mouth, literally from Tupps Brewery. And
I'm saving this other. I'm saving the other one. So I'm going to revisit this here in a couple of weeks to give
this. This would be like the perfect beer either as your first beer to get the buzz early.
Yep.
Or as your third or fourth when taste doesn't matter. And it puts you over the top.
There you go.
That's what this is for. So
good stuff.
All right. Well, I know you got places to be. So another great episode. I'll let you finish it out.
As always, you can find us over at persuasionbythepint.com. You can find us on all of your podcast platforms. And Sean, it's been fun, man. I'm looking forward to 2021 as we continue on putting out good content and having some great guests on here this upcoming year, man.
Cool. We're going to start doing good content. That's awesome.
Finally. fine.
Yeah, we're warmed up now. We're getting warmed up.
Now that this episode has transpired and we talk about, you know, experiential changing people's behaviors.
Yes.
You know, maybe we should do that in our content. That's a good
idea. There we go.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. As always, have a happy new year, and we'll see you in 2021.
See ya.